You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, your letters and Steph Curtis's 5 for 5. But first, the clowns and the clods and the boars that populate Payne University. The English department, over which Professor Jason Fitker presides, is dysfunctional and fractious. In his first week as chair, Fitker can't even find a computer that works or an administrator that will forgive his cluelessness. He is, as Julie Schumacher renders him in her new novel, hapless and hopeless. Or is he? The Shakespeare requirement is U of M creative writing professor Julie Schumacher's second go-round at Payne University. She joins me in the studio to talk about it. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Why would any parent send their precious child to Payne University if they had any idea what goes on behind the scenes there?
Why would any parent send any child to any university,
well,
knowing how the sausage is made?
Is that what you're saying? This is, I mean, if you knew the pettiness, the churlishness, the cutthroat competition that goes on behind the scenes, parents would be appalled.
I think you could probably say the same for elementary school or your local dentist office or anything else. Behind the scenes is a different view.
This is exactly what I want to. So you've led me right to this, Julie. I want to talk to our audience about the absurdities in your own workplace, like the language that you use if you're in your own workplace and the things that you know that are absurd about the field you're in. So let that bubble a little bit. I mean, only the things you know that you have to laugh about that drive you crazy. Okay, think about that a little bit. You can join us when you've come up with something. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. I know this is satirical. You and I have talked about satire before, but it is, I mean, as with most effective satire, there's truth at the core of it. And I guess I wonder if there is, if the foolishness, if the truth is important, but the foolishness of that truth is really important too, to be able to see the whole picture here. Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think they are equally important. And I think satire is one way of getting at the truth in a very hyperbolic, exaggerated sort of way. I'm not portraying a real university. I have a great job.
Oh, really?
I am not. Payne University is a very strange place, but it's not the place where I work at the U of M.
Okay, noted disclaimer. Has that happened in every single interview you've done
where
you've
ask,
been like, I must put in this disclaimer?
I do feel I need to put that disclaimer in there. People ask me, do your colleagues still talk to you? And I say, I love my colleagues. The dean of the College of Liberal Arts threw me a party.
Really?
After my last book.
Good sport.
Won the Thurber. He's been terrific, as has my chair. So I am making fun of the most weird aspects of higher ed. And I'm also pointing out, I think, things that bother me about the situation currently in higher education. The massive emphasis on the STEM fields above all else. The, you know, lesser interest and backing of the arts and humanities, which to me are extremely important. So I'm both having my fun and trying to say something serious at the same time.
I think satire also works when there is, and I think I read this in your novels about Payne University, an undercurrent of anger. I don't know that you're camouflaging that anger very effectively. Come on, admit it. You feel it.
Oh,
some of this stuff drives you crazy.
Oh, sure. Lots of things drive me crazy. There's plenty of red tape and bureaucracy at a place the size of the university where I work. But again, I think those sorts of things, the best thing about these books for me is that I was
able. And
this
is the second?
Yes. This is
second
the second
on Payne
book
University,
featuring
right.
Jason T. Fitker, my
And there might be more
professor.
Coming.
We'll see. is I was able to create this alter ego for myself. Jason Fitker. He and I share a first initial, J. He's called J. That's my initial.
Uh-huh.
And he is really ticked off I am, in general, a fairly polite, mild-mannered person.
This is why I don't believe and... that there isn't this strong undercurrent of anger running. You are too calm and too unruffled, Julie, to be believed writing novels like this.
Oh, it's great to it's great to create a little evil version of yourself and let that version say whatever it would like. It's a huge relief. You should try it sometime.
It's a huge relief. Okay, why?
Because, again, in the first novel, which was composed entirely of letters of recommendation, that's a very restricted form. You can't do anything interesting when you write a letter of reference for a student. You're not supposed to be interesting. You're supposed to simply advocate for that person and say, this is a terrific individual, you should hire him or her. And a person like myself, who's a writer, gets tired of writing the exact same appropriate letter all the time. But of course, I would never write the letters that my character writes. He's incredibly inappropriate. He's a loudmouth. He's a jerk. But boy, was it fun to let loose with that form and let him say all these things that I would never allow myself to say.
So the first novel about Payne University was, as Julie is describing, this series of letters where personalities and, again, the absurdity of the university are revealed through these letters. This one, you freed yourself of the letter writing form and we're just all in on the day-to-day competition and pettiness and, as I said, churlishness of the people that teach at Payne University. Much more freeing to be out of the letter form?
Actually, counterintuitively, the letter form was pretty freeing.
Really?
There were many, many decisions I did not have to make as a writer because they had already been made for me by my choice of that very, very specific format. In this book, I opened all the doors and windows. I go into the points of view of the evil economist, Roland Gladwell, who is upstairs, Fitker's upstairs neighbor in Willard Hall, into the point of view of a very shy undergraduate, Angela, who gets herself into trouble, a graduate TA, an aging Shakespearean. I wanted to be able to get into all these different perspectives to show that, yes, there's all this absurdity at Payne University, but there are also these people who, though eccentric as they may be, care enormously about what they're doing.
I mean, that's the duality of this. They are absurd in the way they behave with one another and in some ways very unself-aware. And yet they, I think all of them, in all of this competitiveness, they are really, what, are they more committed, though, to their advancement, or are they truly committed to the mission of the university?
Well, I think my character of the undergraduate, Angela, shows that they are committed actually to students.
Okay.
You've got the two competing interests within the Department of English, Cassavan, the Shakespearean, and Jason Fitker, who just wants this horrible document that is driving him wild, signed, sealed, and delivered by his faculty. And the two of them are arguing back and forth, really don't want to be in the same room with one another, but they are both teaching this undergraduate during the same semester and both care about her very much.
Mm. You won the James Thurber Award for Dear Committee Members, which was the first Payne University novel. And I recently read an interview with Thurber that he did with the Paris Review about writing humor. And he said, with humor, you have to look out for traps. You're likely to be very gleeful with what you first put down, and you think it's fine, very funny. One reason you go over and over is to make the piece sound less as if you were having a lot of fun with it yourself. You try to play it down. What does that say to you?
That's really interesting. Because for me, writing a first draft, I am trying initially just to please myself. I don't want to think about what an editor or my friend down the street who's a writer will think of it. I need really just to burrow into my own point of view and think about what will please and amuse me. But yes, going over it later, you do need to think, is this just funny for one person on the planet, and that's myself? Or is there something larger here that contains some meaning, something that will matter?
It kind of sounds like another version of what I've heard writers say about killing your children, right?
Killing your darlings, yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What is that to you? What kind of advice is that to you?
Well, it's a matter of seeing the whole. I think as a writer, again, I first try to have the writer's mind while I'm drafting something. And then later on, I try to have more of an editorial mind. Mm. But I need to keep the editorial mind at bay until I can bring it back. And then that editorial mind is the one that might tell me, you may love this paragraph or this page or this chapter, but it's going to go.
I hear that. But aren't there moments when you when you think you've got the novel pretty much ready to go and you allow yourself a little indulgence to say, that is one great page of dialogue, or, man, I hit it right there. Thurber would say, don't show yourself having too much fun or you know, feeling too, I guess, elated mm-hmm. about what you've written. But, I mean, that's a natural thing
I think,
to experience, yeah.
Feeling elated. I think most of the time as a writer, I feel frustrated more than elated. So I don't know that I would thoroughly agree with Thurber on that one, though I love Thurber.
But you don't go back through and say, nailed it.
No, and in...
come on.
No, not with this book.
Really?
I initially had probably 100 pages of a different version and sent it to the editor who said, it's not working. And I kept looking at it thinking, he's wrong. I can't believe this. It has to be. I know it's working. It's working. And eventually I thought, dang it, he's right. It's not working. I started it entirely over again. Initially, it was written not in the form of letters, but as a chair's log. It was basically Fitger's first year diary as chair. And it was going to be annotated by his ex-wife, Janet, who gives him the chair's log, the empty diary at the beginning of the book. And I wanted to have her as a sort of editor on his diary. And the editor said, you're writing the same book you wrote the last time. It's going to drive itself into the ground. You're painting yourself into a corner, whatever the metaphor might be. And eventually I had to acknowledge that he was right.
Jeez.
And I tossed it and started again.
Ouch. I mean, toughest of moments when your first instinct would be, well, I'm the one that wrote the first book that won the Thurber Award.
Dang
so
it. Yeah, let me do it the way I want.
Who really knows what they're doing here? What do you think he saw besides the repetition that was missing in your own view?
I think he did see, as I did not at the time, that opening it up so as to see all these other people's points of view, not just to see Payne University the way Fitger sees it, but to see it the way a graduate student sees it, to see it the way somebody who's at the top of the heap, President Hoffman in the novel, sees it, to see it the way all these different people would view it from their own perspectives.
Do you think doing it the second way around allowed you to create this kind of perfect villain, or would that have been accessible to you the other way in The Economist?
Yeah, The Economist, he was going to be in the other version, but I did not have the undergraduate, Angela, in the other version. And I think that allowed the book to feel a bit more compassionate, a bit more humane, because the, mm-hmm. You know, the satire and the humor can start to feel snarky, I think. And I also wanted there to be a real sense of compassion and kindness and people who do care about each other, despite the wackiness of the general milieu.
I think this is a good point. When snarkiness starts to spill into kind of a cruel edge, mm-hmm. and it's even maybe in that moment that Thurber's talking about where you're gleefully caught up in the snark and you lose that sense of, I've really spilled into a place here where my audience is maybe going to sit back and mm-hmm. say, this is kind of mean.
Or, yeah, you lost your connection to the reader. And I think a lot of writers discover that moment for the first time if they're writing anything that bears a resemblance to their own family members. And then you say, hey, Mom, Dad, listen to what I wrote. And you see the looks on their faces and you think, yeah, this was fun for me, but no one else is amused.
Doesn't every writer draw on some kind of autobiography?
Sure, sure.
Right?
Sure.
I mean, you've done that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And, do you want to talk about that right now?
Probably not.
Julie Schumacher is in studio this morning, and we're talking about, is this a trilogy? What, the second, you don't know?
I don't at this point plan for a third book about Fitger. I feel I've left him at the end of this novel where I see him ending up.
But well, what about Janet?
I know.
What about the undergrad?
I would never say never. Yeah,
I don't know if I can leave Payne University alone.
I know.
Here.
I do worry about Angela still.
I know.
Yeah.
Julie Schumacher in studio, and we're talking about the newest book that she's written called The Shakespeare Requirement about Payne University. She's a U of M creative writing professor. She's at the U, and she's drawn on, although she denies a lot of her personal experiences and just the infuriating things that come up, I think, in any field. I was saying to Phil Picardi this morning that we could just go on and on about what it's like to talk in public radio, right? Inside jokes.
I'm sure.
The infuriating things about working in public radio.
Well, after I graduated from college, I thought I was going to go to New York and get an editing job. It was going to be very glamorous. I had no experience, no connections, no knowledge of the field, but that didn't stop me. And I ended up being a typist at a company that was producing medical magazines sponsored by drug companies. I ended up writing cardiology articles without ever having taken a biology class in college.
Why not?
That was a really absurd job, but it was vastly amusing. It was a real cubicle farm kind of place, and the journals we produced were pretty awful, but no one seemed to care much.
So I'm asking you, as you listen into the conversation this morning, if you could, if you channel a similar experience here, I mean, if there's an absurdity in your profession that only you know about, but man, you could list like the most ridiculous things immediately. You can share that. You can get that off your chest with us this morning, should you need to. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieMPR, where Joel says, and I bet this is right, letter carriers. Everyone has a pile of ideas about what our job is like that they love to share with us. Yeah, if I was doing that job, they're often wrong. We all complain to each other about the one-liners we hear again and again.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. I mean, think about the kind of coded language that you communicate. It's the shorthand, right, in a certain profession.
Sure, sure.
You don't need to fill in the blanks.
And I think most writers have the experience of being in the grocery store and having their friend or neighbor come up to them and say, I have the best idea for a book. You should write this.
What do you say when people say that?
You should write this. Like this is a book you should write.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Why are people always willing to share their ideas for their books with you? Because it would take sitting down in front of the
computer. Yeah, it's a pain in the neck to sit down and churn out 300 pages.
You know, I was curious, when you were being that typist at that medical magazine company, were you kind of romanticizing about an eventual career as a college professor and as a writer?
Never.
Maybe. Not really.
No.
None of that was on the, nothing about that was on the horizon.
I wanted to write. I did love writing. I always wanted to, but I never imagined I could have the job I have now.
Why?
Well, I was thinking maybe I would go back to school and get an education degree. I could be a Spanish teacher. I had studied Spanish and Latin American studies as an undergrad. Mm-hmm. And maybe be a journalist, maybe be a translator. Never occurred to me I would, you know, one day publish a book and get to teach creative writing.
Well, so how did you get to, I'm going to write and I'm going to end up teaching about writing too? I mean, I thought that was a very, you know, kind of intentional path that one is on to become a college professor.
I took a class as an undergrad, a creative writing class, and we were supposed to write a family tale. And I did that, and my professor sent it off to this contest at the California Quarterly Magazine, and it won third prize.
Wow.
I got $50, and I thought, wow, this is great. About a year later, I get a letter that had been sent to me at various addresses where I'd been living post-college.
Following you around. Okay.
And it was from Houghton Mifflin, and my story was going to be reprinted in the Best American Short Stories, edited that year by Ann Tyler, whom I idolized.
Yeah.
I just...
Wow.
Loved her work. And it was the only story I'd ever written. You know, I had not written anything else or published anything else. And it gave me such a huge boost. It was sort of somebody opening a door in front of me and saying, you know what? You could do this. So with that one little story, I applied to grad school and miraculously got in, and then got there and thought, I'd better start writing something else because this is all I have.
Grad school for creative writing.
Yes, I went to Cornell and
got
an MFA.
That is quite the leap of faith there, Julie.
It was a big leap of faith.
What, as you look back on that, what do you understand about that decision that you made based on some, a little bit of flimsy evidence.
Very flimsy.
Although when Ann Tyler chooses, there's something going on there.
And it's interesting, I had to submit a biographical statement for the Best American Short Stories, and I tried to make myself sound very important. I was 23 years old, I had written nothing, but I said I was working as an editor and translator in New York City, which was, I was a typist, was what I was doing. But it was a huge fortuitous thing that came out of nowhere and sent me in a direction I had not quite imagined.
I mean, you've obviously played the what if. What if I hadn't sent off what if I hadn't submitted the story and the professor had been busy that day and not said, all of that.
Yeah.
Where do you think life would have taken you?
Maybe I'd have been a Spanish teacher.
Maybe.
I don't know. Could
and
be.
As truly fulfilled as you are today.
Who knows?
Right.
I think, that's the sort of alternate life that you never know. What if you had gone to the other college and met the other person
That's
and married
right.
that person and
exactly.
taken that other job? And
you never know.
Had those other children. Who knows?
What if you had taken a we could go on about this for the whole rest of the hour. Liz in St. Paul says, I work on document reviews for attorneys. You're just clicking buttons and looking at junk emails. You read the craziest things, crazy graphic love letters. And awkward ones, too. Oh.
Crazy graphic
Liz,
love
there's
letters.
A book in there.
Oh, yeah.
Somewhere. Right.
That's something I often assign to students in terms of a fiction writing assignment. Start with a job that you have had. Even if you're 18, 19 years old, you've had a babysitting job, you've cut lawns during the summer, you've worked at Dairy Queen, whatever it might be. And as soon as I mention jobs, everybody's got an idea. Because people have always had some strange, wacky thing happened to them while they're at work.
Yeah, that's true. And often is it you're at that first job age where everything is new.
Sure.
You don't know how to handle unusual situations.
Exactly. Yeah. My first job was at a candy and ice cream store, and I was fired for not knowing how to make a banana split. Somebody came in and asked for a banana split. I didn't know what it was. It didn't occur to me you would really
how
put a banana with ice cream.
How does one get to a certain age without knowing how to make a banana split?
I didn't understand the idea of the banana split and was promptly let go.
And so the manager of the place came back to you and said, well, we certainly couldn't have you working here.
Exactly.
If you don't know how to make a banana split.
Yeah, I think that was pretty much it.
Oh my gosh. Julie Schumacher with us in the studio this morning. We're talking about her new novel, The Shakespeare Requirement. I'm going to ask her to read an excerpt from the pages here when we get a look at the latest news. And you can feel free to share your stories of the absurdity in your own profession. Heard about letter carriers. We've heard about document reviewers for attorneys. I'd like to hear from you about that. 651-227-6000. Elizabeth called to say, I worked at the Minnesota State Fair. The people I worked with, horse show judges, 4-H students, the grandmothers that called in to ask about their unusually large squashes. Very funny. You could do a Parks and Rec style show on them. To Frank in Worthington. Hey, Frank.
Hey.
Hi. What's your story?
I don't have a story, but I have a question.
Okay.
So I worked as a wedding server over the summer, and nothing takes the magic out of a wedding like being the person who serves food at it.
For sure.
So my question for your guest is, when you have students write about work experiences, and from that kind of overlooked or sort of ignored perspective, does it make you rethink certain situations, or, does it have kind of a therapeutic value on getting workers to share their experience of certain situations we take for granted?
That's a really good question.
Oh, I think both. Definitely both. Because I have no idea what the insider's view of being a wedding server might be, but I'm interested to find out because that's another probably weird little world. The only reason that you have all these novels about academic satire is that the people writing them are English professors and writers. Maybe there aren't as many writers in the wedding catering field or in whatever other field could be.
So when your students are writing about their work experiences, I think Frank's also asking this, is it giving you a new perspective on what your own work experiences, or I don't know, insight mm-hmm. into their lives and the stories that they're bringing to the discussion?
Definitely. And I also tell people to start with just the general workaday world in which they're involved, and then develop a sort of what-if scenario.
Oh,
so
I like
what
that.
If the person coming, serving at the wedding, tripped and something happened to the wedding cake? Or what if the mother of the bride realized that the server was her illegitimate child? You know, you could go anywhere in fiction. It's great fun.
Call from Jay in Northfield. Hi, Jay.
Hi.
Hi. So what do you know about your profession? You're a pilot, is that right?
Right. I was a military pilot. Now I'm a commercial airline pilot, but I'm also a writer. I taught English at the Air Force Academy. So I'd actually written and performed a play in New York. But in terms of, you know, the whole pilot world and pilot experiences, there's just so many obviously crazy stories.
I'm afraid to hear them.
I know. I've actually, people have talked and said, hey, that's the direction you should do because everyone would want to know. So, but I have written another play that I probably might perform in New York as well, but called Waiting to Crash, The Making of a Military Pilot. My kind of story anecdote was I was, you know, one of the many anecdotes. I was flying in the military, and sometimes you would fly these really long missions, 12-hour days, and you're getting back at landing at 2 or 3 in the morning, and people are exhausted and tired. And I remember one time looking over at my co-pilot and asking him to put the gear down as we were coming in on final approach, and he'd fallen asleep in the right seat of the airplane.
Yeah.
So that kind of gets your attention. So it's exactly those stories like this.
So
Jay, what does it spark?
You know what occurs to me about that is you probably didn't panic. I mean, to the outside looking in, that looks like an emergency situation to us. My co-pilot's asleep. He's not responding to commands. But you, because you're in this field, know that's another thing to factor in as you do your job competently.
Yeah, exactly. I just actually reached over and put the gear down and kind of tapped him. And I said, I did that for you.
Oh, jeez.
And he's like, oh my God, I was asleep.
Hey, really good to have the call, Jay. Glad. And good luck with the writing. That's really great.
Thank you very much.
Mallory says on Twitter, I work at a library. We have a bunch of regular patrons. Is there a great place for observation than a library? Some are great, while others are interesting. We get to know a lot about these people. Some of the information is welcome, but a large portion is cringeworthy oversharing.
Oh, I bet librarians have a lot to tell. I bet they have a lot of things to say.
Is oversharing a thing among college professors?
I wouldn't say oversharing is a thing, no.
Maybe you don't overshare.
I try not to.
I sense you're not that type.
I'm not.
Boy, there's a lot of oversharers out there. What gives with that?
I can't tell you. I have no idea.
Okay, I'd love it if you'd read. Tell us a little bit about, there's a debate going on at Payne University about whether Shakespeare should be required if you're going to get a degree in English. Mm-hmm. And there's a discussion about whether we should just eliminate Shakespeare. And that is very disturbing to the Professor Casavant,
yes,
who has been there for a long time.
He's a Shakespeare specialist, and he has just found out that the department may eliminate the requirement that undergraduates majoring in English take Shakespeare.
Can you see your page there? Because I have it very dim in the studio.
It's fine.
Are you okay?
Fine.
Okay.
Yes. Casavant closed his eyes for a moment, feeling ill. The very marrow of the discipline would be expunged. He had to hold himself partly responsible. During the year he had been on sabbatical, he had scarcely glanced at the daily deluge of e-correspondence or the minutes of meetings. But now, email by email, he followed a months-long electronic rabbit trail which revealed that, in addition to electing Fitger, a hodgepodge of exhausted colleagues had collectively assembled this impossible document as if dragging a one-legged blind man through multiple layers of the committee system. Perhaps the intent had been to obey some bizarre directive from above, but the outcome was, for the students, an irresponsible freedom, No need for the English major to familiarize him or herself with Chaucer or Milton, let alone Spenser or Donne, all of whose works had been discarded in an earlier purge. Now Shakespeare himself was to be lobbed like a tidbit of refuse into the bin. And what might Paine's young literary scholars study instead? Bracing himself, Casaubon returned to the course catalogue. Upcoming classes included Aliens and Outlaws, Marxism 2.5, The American Soap and the Telenovela, and The Literature of Deviation. How was a student to make any sense of it? Shakespeare was the cornerstone, the fountainhead. To allow an undergraduate English major to earn a diploma without studying Hamlet and Lear, and either Julius Caesar or Antony and Cleopatra, was on the part of the faculty an abdication. Read whatever you like. We aren't here to offer intellectual guidance. Our field is a come-what-may experience. Anything goes.
Julie Schumacher reading from her new novel, The Shakespeare Requirement. Back to Chaucer. So were you an English lit major?
I was not. I was a Spanish.
Spanish. Okay. I wondered. Mm-hmm. So have you read Chaucer in an academic setting?
I have not. I have not. See, this is a great work of fakery I'm pulling off here. I never took a Shakespeare class.
What?
As an undergrad.
Way to bury the lead.
Exactly.
What?
Exactly. Yeah.
So have you taken one in graduate school?
Nope.
You never had to take Shakespeare in grad school?
No, because
you have always read Shakespeare untutored.
Exactly.
Wow.
I did have assistance from a colleague who allowed me to come into her class, and I grilled her undergrads and asked them, should Shakespeare be required for people majoring in English?
What'd she say?
Well, the students answered, they had a sort of poll to answer, and I got about 50-50 response. Half of the students said, yes, we should all take Shakespeare, because if we aren't taking Shakespeare, there's no foundation to the discipline. They basically said, as Casaubon does in the passage that I read, there has to be a foundation, as there is in chemistry or physics or math. There needs to be some sort of structure in order that this be a legitimate discipline. The other half said, arguably, equally valid point, why should we have one entire semester dedicated to one author who died 500 some years ago when there are so many things that one could read that have value and could be studied? Why not lump Shakespeare in, for example, with Chaucer or Milton or Spenser?
And, you know, I've really thought about this because I had an entire, was it three full semesters of Shakespeare as an English lit major? And that was one of the most indelible experiences of my university.
Fewer schools require Shakespeare.
Really?
Yeah. The University of Minnesota still does if you are majoring in English, but many, many schools don't.
I remember my professor Gray Lewis, this is a long time ago, would perform basically the, and I think we snickered at it as students at the time, but it really made it vivid because I can remember specific moments from that.
Exactly.
So you've never had to read Chaucer either.
No, but I read Don Quixote in the original.
Okay. Well, then. So how do you personally feel about reading lists?
I think people, you know, need to read, and reading is disappearing, again, because of this constant emphasis on all things technological. I'm kind of a Luddite. I don't like the cell phone. I don't...
I remember this from previous conversations.
I normally don't use a cell phone. I'm always shocked and surprised when it rings and feel sort of offended.
So you don't have a smartphone, probably, because you're calling
forced,
it a cell phone. Oh, you
I
do have one.
I was forced to get one when I went to Europe last time because my tiny flip phone would no longer work.
Uh-huh.
But I don't really like them. I still write by hand on paper.
Okay, so, but to the reading list, so are you saying you feel there's a tradition about reading lists that are valuable, or?
Well, and I personally, I duck the whole Shakespeare question myself because I don't teach Shakespeare. I typically teach undergrad or graduate creative writing. I teach fiction.
But
so
in
so
if
not
I
have
on
a reading list,
yes.
it's not to include Shakespeare because
I'm
teaching contemporary literature.
Take Shakespeare out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe, though, there ought to be recurring novels on reading lists that you that are just essential to the development of these students who are taking the classes?
Yes and no. Yes, because I definitely want there to be reading lists, and no, because the reading list will always change. The reading list changes over time. Look at what's happened even in K through 12 with To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
Is that book still going to be on the required lists, or is it going to be replaced? I can see a very valid argument for both sides.
Mm-hmm. So the reading list is going to be changed at your level, at your direction.
Yes.
Yeah. But when we're talking about K through 12, you would advocate, it sounds like, for a more flexible kind of reading list.
Oh, I think the reading list is going to be flexible no matter the age.
Well, you say that, but they often aren't. I mean, the same books often show up year to year.
Sure. And in part, that's because faculty like me don't want to reinvent the list every year. That's a lot of work.
Animal Farm, right? I read it, you know, I think the Lord of the Flies.
Yep.
I read it. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, students are saying, is that valuable?
Yes. I think it is valuable to have, we used to have at the U of M, a freshman reader. So everybody coming in to the College of Liberal Arts would read the same book. They'd be given the book. And just to have that touchstone, you're in line in the dining hall, you're in your dorm, and somebody says to you, hey, what did you make of that weird part of the novel where et cetera, yeah. happened? I think that's a great thing. I want people to have those touchstones, and those exist partly from bestseller lists when you're talking about contemporary literature, from talking volumes, which you do.
Oh, gold
are,
point for you.
Those are touchstones.
Right there, yeah.
So
do you get the sense that the students, I hope this is true, that are taking your creative writing classes are adventurous and wide readers? Or do you think, you know, kind of reading for pleasure is giving way to trying to absorb all the information that's out there at your fingertips?
I think there is that. I think there is that danger. Teaching undergrad fiction right now, and I always ask people, so what's the last great book that you read, something you loved? And many of them will say, I haven't had time. I was working, I'm taking 5 classes. Reading for pleasure? No, I haven't had time.
Do you think that's an excuse?
No. I think, you know, many students at the U are. They're working a couple of jobs. They've, you know, some of them have children, some of them have families, they have complicated situations. They're taking lots of classes. But technology, again, back to the
evil. That's kind of why I asked.
It takes up
right?
a lot of our time. I think, you know, I have a lot of time to read because I don't know how to program my computer or watch TV anymore. I gave up on TV about 5 years ago because it got too complicated.
You are missing some great storytelling.
I know. People always talk to me about this or that Netflix series. I haven't watched anything.
There is that. But, I mean, you're missing that, but big deal. You're getting even more.
I don't care.
In gray.
Let me miss it. Let me miss more of it.
Right. I asked you about the reading because I think we're also in a time. I don't want to be, you know, wringing my hands. Well, people don't read.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like we're in a time where it's an era that feels urgent and difficult. And a lot of that reading space is being taken up with, well, I have to read that 20-page New Yorker article about the Mueller investigation, you know, mm-hmm. or something like mm-hmm. that. That's what concerns me is the higher, bigger truths that fiction can tell kind of gets pushed aside mm-hmm. for the urgency of the moment we're in.
Or by just the soundbite, the snippet. We're used to snippets now rather than, you know, reading War and Peace and finding what we can find
Even
in there.
I'm not going back to read War and Peace. But, okay, so last great book you read.
Last great book. I'm right now reading Richard Powers' The Overstory.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is a stunning, stunning piece of work.
Way to take
original,
mine that I was going to tell you.
Yeah. No, it's just,
what do you love about it?
Well, I'm not done. I'm about two-thirds of the way through. But just the way in which human beings are secondary to something much larger that's happening is, to me, absolutely magnificent.
The story, he was on the show probably a couple months ago, and the story of his experience of walking through the woods. He's living in, I think, near the Great Smoky Mountains.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So he's walking through those woods there,
mm-hmm.
and his powers of observation, which of course are finely tuned anyway as a writer.
Amazing.
But what he sees in a walk, it has changed the way
yep.
I see the world around me.
It does. It changes
me.
The way you think. Yes.
Right? That's
and
great
I think
fiction
it's a great
right
thing
there.
That novels can do.
Right.
They can change you more so sometimes than the article, The New Yorker, about the Mueller
you
investigation.
Got it. Totally. Julie, this has been really fun.
Thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very
Thank
much.
Thank you. Julie Schumacher's novel is called The Shakespeare Requirement, and you can read more about it at The Thread. I've been hearing from a number of you on the shows that we're doing. I got a lot of tweets and a lot of mail on the payday loan conversation that we had yesterday. Listener tweeted in, I was personally in the situation of making $17,000 a year, unable to cover bills, paying overdraft fees, felt helpless. It isn't always a choice to borrow at a high interest rate. Matthew tweeted in, this is an incredibly important conversation. Thank you for it and the experts you have on today. It can't be considered without thinking about race and class, historic inequities, and access to banking and capital. Rosemary tweeted in, the 30 Days Foundation will help folks who need short-term help. 30 Days doesn't give cash to the person, but rather pays the rent to landlords. XL provides gas cards, grocery cards, or any vendor, whatever they need. They need only call and ask. And Lindsay tweeted, breaking the cycle requires a higher minimum wage, investment in affordable housing, and a better social safety net so people aren't balancing on the edge of poverty. I think that was one of the takeaways from that show, is that as it was with our 9 a.m. criminal justice conversation, that the scale of this is so complicated that when you are going to solve one problem, you find yourself inevitably talking about how to solve the other problem. It's on the podcast if you want to go back and listen to that. We also talked about landlords. We heard from people on evictions and landlords, and Will wrote in to say, landlord's primary concern is defense of property rights. What in the world is your guest talking about? We were forced into being landlords after the financial crisis hit. I can say as a former landlord that my primary concern was paying my mortgage and thus getting rent, not defense of property rights. Eviction is a last resort. And Brian wrote in on our show about free tuition for medical school. The issue is one of subsidies. In the 1980s, when I went to college at the University of Minnesota, the corporate tax rate was much higher. Now that corporate taxes have been slashed, the end result is higher tuition. Working for Northern States Power, I witnessed a similar situation with gas and electric rates. As commercial and industrial rates were decreased, residential rates were increased. So if you missed any of our conversations about evictions and free medical school tuition and criminal justice reform and payday lending, you can find them all on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts. Steph Curtis is here. Time for 5 for 5. You better explain what this is because it's been a while since we've done it.
It's been a little while. In 5 minutes, I try to give you 5 things to experience, read, listen to, or watch. And I don't want to waste any more time, so here I go. Mary B. by Catherine Chen. This is a first-time novelist who's taken on an aspect of Pride and Prejudice that you haven't probably paid much attention to. Poor Mary Bennett. She's the middle daughter, kind of mousy.
Do I care about Mary?
You do, care about
okay.
it. You get the point of view of not just Pride and Prejudice's story, but beyond that. And what would happen to a woman who is not attractive, is plain, but also has a big inner life. So it is a great retelling of Pride and Prejudice through the point of view of the middle child, Mary. She's the one who's always playing piano.
I was going to say, she doesn't care about getting married.
No, and
yeah.
all that.
She has a life of the mind, you're saying.
It is such a delightful novel. It is so much fun to read. Mary B. by Catherine Chen.
Okay.
Number two, Anne Applebaum's article in The Atlantic about Poland. And her husband had been the foreign minister of Poland, and she's a historian, has written a lot about communism under Stalin, and Russia under Stalin. And this is about a long view of what happens to a democracy as it's fading and falling to pieces. But she looks back all the way to the Dreyfus Affair and how that still divides France in some ways. and looks at Poland, which she knows intimately, not just in the long view, but also in why this person suddenly decided to become an anti-Semite and how they got a job running the major media companies. It is a fascinating look at a country that is falling to pieces.
Boy,
in some
this
ways.
Is so timely, too, because of what's happening in Hungary right
now
with the rise of right-wing nationalists there. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Anne Applebaum from The New Yorker.
It's called, from The Atlantic.
From
it's
the
called
Atlantic.
Warning from Europe, the worst is yet to come.
Okay.
There you go.
Oh.
A Simple Favor is a movie that's opening this Friday. Blake Lively and Anna Kendrick. It is a thriller about two women who suddenly have a tight friendship, and then one of the women disappears. And you learn more about both of their backgrounds. And it's not just a thriller. It's comedic. It's part screwball comedy, part Hitchcock.
Does it work?
Yes, it totally works. There are a lot of twists and everything, but at the center of it is Anna Kendrick, who's just a great actress, and Blake Lively, who, yes, I know she's gorgeous and she looks like a model, but she is a wonderful screen presence, and she has a delicious role. It is so much fun for the thrills of it and for the comedy and chemistry between the two
women.
You know
what this sounds a little bit like? Is it that show called The Search Party?
What's
it called?
Search Party. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the imposters. Isn't that what it's called, where the people are con artists?
It's a TV show where somebody's disappeared,
yeah.
And it's kind of funny, but it's
serious. I love that. I like Search Part of the TV show.
It's kind of like this. Okay.
It's great. Simple Favor, screwball comedy thriller, believe it or not. Bradley Cooper's A Star is Born is coming out, so it's a good time.
I have really wanted to know what you think of this.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
I'm dying to see it.
It's Lady Gaga as the star.
Barbara Streisand. And more importantly, Janet Gaynor. The original A Star is Born came out in the 30s, starring Frederick March, Wisconsinite. He was from Racine, Wisconsin, I do believe. And Janet Gaynor as the fresh-faced ingenue who becomes a star as his star is fading. And unlike the Christofferson Streisand version.
Wait a minute. My husband and I just watched it. It holds up pretty well.
There's a lot more chemistry between the two. And the script. I mean, I know that Didion and John Gregory Dunn wrote the Star is Born Streisand script, but it really is a Streisand movie. And this one with Janet Gaynor and Frederick March is more of a serious drama than the Streisand remake. It is moving. It is there's a touching parts. And Janet Gaynor is just wonderful as this. You really believe that she has it in her to be a star, but that she's also this pure, sweet, wonderful woman. And Frederick March, you really buy into his decline.
Could
it's a
anyone
great movie.
Ever be as sexy as Kris Kristofferson?
You know, he's so, you know, in the...
Oh, man.
He's so checked out, and he looks bored. He looks so bored during the movie.
We read some interview where he said something like, performing in that movie with Streisand cured him of wanting to be a movie star or something.
All right. Anyway, I recommend the first
The original,
A Star Is Born,
I gotcha.
And I can't wait to see the remake. Oh, and lastly, Church's My Enemy, Lauren Mayberry's soaring synth pop voice. I love it. Along with dad rocker Matt Berninger from The National. It's a great combo.
5 for 5, Steph Curtis on Thursdays. Nicely done.
Thank you.
I got no more time to hear what you think about me. Because all your words are so cold, so callous, so clean.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.